Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Kylie Reed, who is out with her debut novel, Such a Fun Age. The book is available now wherever your fine books are sold. And this is one hell of a debut, by the way. Number four at the New York Times bestseller list. It debuted. It's been on the list for 3 weeks now. It's a Reese's Book Club selection, and the book, Kylie, it was a page turner. I mean, it wasn't a thriller in as much as the shoot 'em up bang bang or anything, but it was a thriller in as much
right.
as it kept me turning the pages. So you put this book together, and it touches on so many issues. But can you kind of summarize for me, because I don't want to give too much away because of the way this book moves, but just where your basic story starts?
Yeah, absolutely. This book starts on a Saturday night in September in 2015, and Amira Tucker is a 25-year-old African-American babysitter who is a bit lost with what she wants to do with her life, but she does love babysitting. And so late one night, she's babysitting a 3-year-old Briar in a grocery store. They're having a great time, but a customer and a security guard, upon seeing a black woman with a white child, accuse her of kidnapping the child. And Briar's mom, Alex, is so humiliated that this happened to her, and she sets out to right the night's wrongs, but it kind of turns into a comedy of good intentions after that.
The way that the story flows is we see this mix of not only racial divide and, you know, the characters, but also a class warfare. And as you set out, that's kind of hard to read for readers, in as much as it makes us uncomfortable, but it makes us keep reading it, because it's kind of like asking somebody how much money they make. You just don't want to talk about those things, even though there are the differences among us. Is that a difficult thing to write and to capture that emotion on paper?
I think the difficult thing is to capture the language that people use when they are trying to hide the fact that they're talking about all of those things, like money and class and bias. I think that the word choices I was using were really important. When I workshopped the novel, I had a couple classmates say, oh, it makes me uncomfortable. Why is everyone talking about money so much? And I think that's a good note, as I wanted to make sure that, you know, I keep readers reading, but I also wanted to keep that uncomfortableness there. And so instead of using dollars and cents, I would use other words like classy or sketchy, or other words that, you know, oh, this isn't a good school, that's a bad school. Things like that that are symbolizing money but aren't saying it outright.
Something else I liked is, as you develop the characters throughout the book, it didn't go in linear fashion for me. There would be a scene, and then there would be a flashback to something in that character's past, perhaps involving their parents, or something that happened earlier in life, a historical situation for them, that kind of explained how they became the people that they are. And that particular writing technique is not something that I've seen in a lot of novels. Why did that work so well for you?
I love seeing a character respond to a situation and then going back in time a little bit and seeing how they got that way. I also think that the way memory works is really interesting. And while I was workshopping, I really wanted to honor the way memory works. And that's not always, you know, facts happening as they happen at the moment. I think what's the most important thing for a reader is how that event happened for that person. And sometimes people see instances in different ways. So while honoring the memory of humans and how that works, and also responding to how technology captures racial bias on film, there's a lot of different perspectives. And I wanted to give the reader all of them so that the reader can make up their own mind.
As you developed Amira Tucker, the babysitter in the book, she reminded me a lot of the character Ben in The Graduate. Kind of a, you know, just out of college, but just kind of coasting through life, doesn't really have a lot of goals. And I think the thing I got is that there was a lot of people judge her for that. She didn't seem to judge herself for that by and large. Is that how, am I reading her character right?
I think so. And I think that a lot of characters around her have this, you know, uncomfortableness with her rejection of careerism. She's definitely not a sellout in any way. She's not just going to pick up with any job because it seems like she should do that at the moment. She's a bit lost. And I think that she does catch herself looking at her friends' lifestyles and their incomes and their apartments and thinking, oh man, like, I'm not there. Should I be there? And I think that that's a really common reaction to be in your 20s when friends start making different amounts of money And you can see how class solidarity either holds people together or tears them apart.
The way that she talks with her friends is different than the way that she talks with her employers.
And I
loved that dichotomy. And, you know, sometimes it's you're two different people. People think that you're two different people if you talk that way. You're certain act a certain way around your significant other or your employer, and you act a certain way around your friends. Really, though, I didn't take that from there. I think that that is all part of what makes up a Myra. And I think she's probably smarter than she even gives herself credit for.
I think so, too. And I think that she's at her best when she is herself. But I definitely know what that's like, too. Like, when I was a receptionist, I had a receptionist voice. That was definitely not like the voice that I had when I was talking to my friends. And I think that Amira's not the only person who changes her voice sometimes. There's another character, Tamara, who is a high-income black woman who's a principal in New York City. And when she's with her girlfriend, she's one person, but when she's trying to be very cool with Amira, she's definitely another person completely. I was really interested to write about code switching and see what it looks like on the page, and it was really important for me to just drop the reader into it and not explain anything, because I think that that's a huge part of the Black experience. It's just responding to the environment you're in and going from there.
I think when authors, and maybe I'm wrong, but when authors write scenes that are heavily dialogued, those are difficult to write because you need to make sure that it flows and sounds natural on the page as it would be said. Something that I've literally never seen before in the hundreds of novels I've read over the years is the way that you incorporated the fact of having children around while you're having a conversation affects how a conversation sounds. And for instance, if we're talking now and, you know, if one of us had a child next to us, it would be, hey, put that down, I'm talking to Kylie. It would be something like that. And you captured that in the book in so many instances, and it didn't break up the flow at all. That had to be a trick.
That's really good to hear, because it's definitely a choreographed train wreck a little bit that you're trying to achieve. There were so many moments, especially in a big Thanksgiving scene where I had about 12 people, that I had to really make sure that I was highlighting who would respond to what and when. And sometimes it's a four-year-old, sometimes it's a baby crying. And I wanted them to just be themselves and have people respond, as you were saying, just in the moment. And that means a mom stopping and looking at her daughter and going, hey, that's one. And everyone kind of knows what that means, even though it's not explained in that moment. Children just say whatever they want, whenever they want it. And so I wanted the tension of having, you know, a high-stakes situation with a child there to be always at the forefront. That was really important.
I'm chatting with Kylie Reed about her brand new novel, Such a Fun Age. The book is available now wherever fine books are sold, and it is also number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list as we're going forward this week. It doesn't seem to be, you know, it's not going to move down anytime soon. It's just going to keep moving up. I know you're a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and I'm going to get into that in a little bit. The book, a lot of it reminded me of, the idea of the book reminded me of a T.C. Boyle book, who's another fine graduate of that institution, because it, a lot of his novels, he will take a certain social situation and develop a novel around it and make us think about things that we otherwise wouldn't. You have a phrase, you've written a phrase in the book that I'd never heard of before, and it's fetishizing black people. Can you explain what that concept is?
Sure. I think that fetishizing black people is a very interesting extension of a white supremacy society, and that's othering a black person to the point where you think their blackness kind of makes you cooler by association. And instead of, you know, thinking that their brain and their mind is beautiful, it's thinking that their culture and their otherness is really beautiful, and that's the winning part about them. And I really wanted characters who toe the line between actually, you know, really caring for someone and fetishizing someone. Because, well, one, I think that's a more interesting character. But two, I think that that's how it works often, not just with fetishizing someone. You hear in, you know, with cases of relationship, oh, this person, you know, he's really capable of loving me, but sometimes he also hurts me. And I think that that's common in a lot of different traits. And so I wanted the characters to, one, love calling each other out for these things that they're often kind of guilty of as well.
A lot of the novel takes place in Philadelphia. The majority of it does. You live there now. Mm-hmm. What made you put it in Philadelphia? Because this could have happened in any city, frankly.
It could have. I think first and foremost, I love Philadelphia a lot. I came here in 2015, and I really fell in love with it, and I came back twice to do research for the novel. I loved how both Alex and Amira view Philadelphia as outsiders. For Alex, it's, well, this is, you know, New York's little sister. Who cares what's happening here? And for Amira, it's where she becomes an adult and she feels really thrilled by the city. So I loved having both of their view of Philadelphia, and also it's just a great place to live.
What years were you in Iowa City at the workshop?
I just graduated in May, and it's a two-year program, so I started in 2017.
Okay, so you were writing this book while you're there, right?
I was. It was my thesis project.
Who were your professors? I mean, I'm familiar with Ethan Kanan, Samantha Chang at the mm-hmm. workshop there. Were those all mentors to you?
They were all teachers, but I was not in their workshop. I had kind of an interesting experience where I took mostly visiting faculty, and the teacher who helped me with this novel was Paul Harding, who was a complete game changer when it came to the novel. I workshopped about 240 pages of it.
And when you say you workshopped it, I don't think a lot of people know what that means. What is it?
Yeah, of course. It's a process that started at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and it's where you deliver a body of work. Your classmates read it the week before. They come in with notes and a letter to you, and then for however long, sometimes it's an hour, sometimes it's 3 hours, they talk about your work while you sit there in complete silence and take it all in.
And, of course, workshopping it under Paul Harding, I mean, a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book Tinkers. I think that came out 9 or 10 years ago. But mm-hmm. I know you were back in Iowa City last week and speaking at Prairie Lights. Is that kind of like a Saturday Night Live alum going back and hosting the show?
That's a really good question. I mean, it was actually really lovely to go. It's, you know, bizarre. I've been going to readings at Prairie Lights for 2 years, and suddenly being there on the other side felt very strange. But I have to say it's really touching to go back and friends, and also when I'm reading, I think, oh, I'm so glad Paul made me change that, or I'm so glad I switched these chapters around because of this classmate I had. So yeah, it was really sweet to go back.
When you're at the workshop and you're there and you know, you're taking criticism, is that one of the biggest things to learn, is how to take criticism of your writing? Because you have to be a hell of a good writer just to get into that program.
Taking criticism is a huge part of the writing process, and I think every writer who comes out of there has had a workshop where they went home and had a little cry and had to make themselves do it again. But I think that the thing about the workshop process is when you have a group of 10 people and they all really gravitate towards one part that was the most exciting for them, a light comes on. And in the same way, if everyone in your class is saying, oh no, this chapter has to go, you know that chapter has to go. It's kind of a nice collective mind. There are certain times where, you know, you get comments that say, oh, I don't like that everyone is, you know, using slang. That was something that I had with agents and editors of saying, maybe you should pull back. But for everyone who has said that, I've had, you know, black women say to me, this is the first book where I've really heard me and my friends speaking. And so you have to give and get a little bit. It's a really tricky process to understand which feedback is really going to serve your narrative and which one might hold it back a little bit.
When you have a debut novel like this, obviously it's not the first thing you've ever written, so it's just the first novel that we've seen that you've written, but you write it in a bubble, and nobody's waiting for it. Now you're going to be having people, what's coming next, you're going to be on deadlines, things like that. What's that do to your psyche as far as you go writing in the future when your first book became such a gangbuster hit?
That's a great question. I'm very interested to see what deadlines will do to my writing, but I typically like being put under pressure. The great thing now is that I do have editors and agents who I really trust, and I feel like I can fail early and often now and get my writing to where it should be. And the fact that I'm writing full-time now opens up so many research possibilities that I wouldn't have had before. So I'm so excited to see what my writing looks like under, you know, both new freedoms and restrictions.
And you've got something coming up in Playboy soon, right?
I do. I have a short story that I workshopped at the workshop as well. It's called Your First Pet and the Street You Live On, and it'll be out in the spring issue of Playboy. I'm very excited.
And luckily, I read it for the articles.
Oh, perfect. That's one I've been working on for 3 years. I'm very excited it landed there.
All right. The book is Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed. It is her debut novel. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a Reese's Book Club selection. The book's available now wherever fine books are sold. Kylie, I loved, loved, loved this book, and thanks for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.